Welcome to The Report Card with Nat Malkus, the education policy podcast from the American Enterprise Institute. Are smartphones and social media bad for kids' mental health? According to a number of recent books, articles, and op-eds, the answer is an emphatic yes. The rise of smartphones and social media corresponded not only to a rise in the incidence of mental health problems, but to a decline in academic performance. Indeed, in popular media, there almost seems to be a consensus emerging. It's the phone, stupid. Well, I'm wary of consensus. So for this episode, I invited Pete Etchells onto the podcast to hear a different side of the case. Pete Etchells is professor of psychology and science communication at Bath Spa University in the UK and the author of Unlocked, The Real Science of Screen Time and How to Spend It Better. Pete Etchells, welcome to The Report Card.
Thank you very much for having me.
So, Pete, before diving in, I want to try and do a little framing around this conversation. So when it comes to technology use, especially with regards to education, I would say there's three kind of claims that I hear. A general claim, a school-specific claim, and then some mental health claims. There's probably more than that. But I want to separate these out a little bit. For example, someone might claim, even if it doesn't cause depression or anything like that, that spending all day on TikTok just isn't a meaningful life. So that's just sort of the general critique. The second, and I personally am pretty set on this one, and we'll discuss that later, but is that kids shouldn't have phones in school. Even if they're fine for kids' mental health, setting that aside, they're just too distracting in school. And then there's this third claim that screens are bad for mental health. They induce anxiety, depression, they're addictive, they destroy lives. Okay, so I'm sure you've heard these thoughts and the first and second kinds of claims. But in your book, I think it's fair to say that you're primarily concerned with this mental health claim that, you know, screens are bad for mental health. Is that a fair framing?
I think so. So the first two, three chapters of the book are around this concept of mental health and what do we mean by that? What do we mean by digital technology or screen time effects on that? Even social media, you know, these are sort of generally very poorly defined constructs. So the first part of the book is really trying to unpack that and try and figure out what the data actually shows us at the minute. And then the latter half of the book is about other things. So it's not really about mental well-being so much as thinking about some of the big worries that we see quite a lot in the news, or the ones that I've seen in the news over the past 10 years or so. They tend to come up quite frequently. And, you know, can we look at them? What's the science behind them? Are these things that we should worry about, or do we need to direct our concerns elsewhere?
And in that public discussion, how well would you say we do at separating these things, right? You could be worried about all kinds of things under the frame of technology or even under the frame of screen time. But oftentimes it seems like, you know, whether it's phones or the algorithm or social media or laptops, these are all different areas that, you know, they have some overlapping things, but we often just kind of agglomerate them together rather than making distinctions between them. Is it difficult to pierce that inspecificity when you're writing about these things?
It's really hard. And, you know, I've spoken to a lot of journalists and a lot of parents over the past couple of months. And, you know, there are lots of understandable, justifiable, reasonable worries about these things. But I find them, those conversations very hard, because even in the space of, you know, a minute's worth of conversation or, you know, two or three sentences, we end up talking about so many different things. And we're talking about them as if they're the same, but they're really not. So, you know, we might be talking about screen time generally. I think increasingly people talk about that less so. We talk about social media, but social media is a poorly specified concept, right? So maybe we're talking about social media and its effects on depression at one point, and then the next minute we're talking about Instagram and suicidal ideation maybe. But these are all very different concepts. And I know it maybe sounds like a bit of a niche semantic issue here, but it's quite an important concept, right? Because what is it specifically that we're concerned about, and therefore why? And this is a real problem in the research literature as well, that we don't do a very good job as scientists trying to research this stuff of really clearly specifying what we mean by social media or social networking site or screen time. And we also don't do a very good job on the other side in terms of mental illness. And what that means for the public debate is that it becomes very easy to be flexible in those arguments and conversations, what we might call kind of researcher degrees of freedom, that you can find papers, you know, if you're trying to drive an argument that social media is really directly linked to decreases in mental illness, you can find papers that support that. If you're trying to drive a suggestion that they're not linked, you can find papers to support that. And what you then do is end up really trying to take apart the other side's research evidence quality and support your own, when actually the reality of the situation is you look at the research as a whole and it's a real mess. We've not really got a good way of researching this yet.
So, you know, I find this interesting. There's an ad campaign on billboards here in the US, and I think it's by Snapchat, but it may be by some other group. And it says, less social media, more Snapchat. Which I think is interesting, but it gets right into this, right? Which is the distinction between what we're talking about. Of course, Snapchat probably is motivated to distance themselves from the negative discussions around social media. But on the research side, you know, let's dive in a little bit here. How much research is there on mental health effects of particular sites or apps? So, for instance, you hear people agglomerate together Facebook, Instagram, and YouTube, but do we know things about those particular sites and their relationships to mental health?
There is some research out there. So there's a lot of research generally in this area. And some people have really made attempts to try and look at some of the more specific things. So I think the majority of it, where it does specify a particular site, tends to focus on Facebook. I think that's just for historical reasons, because it's the social media site that's probably been around the longest and the one that researchers themselves are most familiar with. There's some research on Instagram and relationships with body image. One of the things about these sorts of studies, where you start to try and get into more specifics, so you're looking at, and you know, a lot of the Facebook stuff is really around what happens if you stop people from using Facebook for a bit, what impact on their well-being is there. You get mixed effects throughout. So sometimes you get studies that show that, you know, if you stop using Facebook for a bit, you see improvements in things like life satisfaction. Other studies, you see reductions in life satisfaction. And again, even there, they're very hard to directly compare those sorts of studies, because there are vast differences in things like the amount of time people stop spending on that particular social network site, how well-being is defined and categorized as well. So the general running theme, no matter sort of which level of specificity you look at in terms of the research literature, the general running theme is that you find mixed effects, right? So sometimes it's a good thing, sometimes a bad thing, sometimes it's neutral. And there's lots of different reasons why you end up finding those effects. And I appreciate that might sound like a bit of a cop-out, but my feeling is that what really that speaks to is something that's true of lots of research in digital technology effects. So prior to being interested in this stuff, I was interested in video games research. You look at the history of video games research, you find the same sort of story, that it's a mess for a long time, because we just can't quite figure out the right way to test the thing that we want to test. And there's lots of heated debate about it and lots of emotion and worry and scare about it. And then that maybe dies down because we start worrying about something else. And then you get the good research, and the good research starts to show, well, maybe this wasn't the worry that we thought it was originally.
As we've talked about, phones are multi-use devices, right? So what are some activities on phones that you think are probably good for us? I mean, certainly there's a hierarchy in what we do on them. How do you think about that?
I find it hard to be prescriptive about that sort of thing, because it tends to be quite individual. And, you know, I play games a lot, so it might be the case that for, you know, I might recommend some games on my phone, but do you know what? Some people might not like those games, so it's not going to work for them. You know, I think one of the big things here is that we've got to be more reflective of our phone use and figure out for us not worrying about maybe what science says about what the good sorts of apps or the bad sorts of apps are, because there's nothing really that science can help inform us on that side of things. But thinking about reflecting on our own use and thinking about, well, when have we had times where we felt like we've overdone it or we've not had a good experience with a particular app? Why is that the case? Do we need to use that app? Do we get any positives out of it? And usually that's the case, right? It's not that something's wholly good or wholly bad for us. There's a mix there. So it becomes more about how do we weed out those habits that we've developed that are maybe not so good for us or don't feel so great, but keeping the positives. So you mentioned email there. That's a great example, right? That we all check our emails on our phone and we've got our phones on us all the time, which means we can check our emails literally at any point. But, you know, we probably don't want to be checking work emails in the evening because we've got other aspects of our lives, right? And I can relate to this, that there have been times recently where I checked my work emails in the evening when I didn't really want to, but I was waiting for something to come in and I check them and then something that I wasn't expecting hits my inbox and I read it and it really stresses me out. And it, you know, it means that maybe I don't go to sleep as easily as I would like to. I shouldn't have been checking my emails, right? You know, I should be restricting those sorts of work-related activities to the work day when I'm paid for it, right? So the answer there is to not take email off my phone necessarily. It's to think about, well, what sorts of boundaries can I put in place for me so that at the end of the work day, I know that I can switch off and maybe I turn off my notifications at that point or switch them off completely so that I have much more control over when I get to see that information rather than when it's pushed to me.
How does this interact with algorithms? Because underneath and often more or less invisible, behind apps or and even really the phones are algorithms that make that an unfair fight in some folks' estimations. How much do you think the worries over the technology and to some degree the potential for links to mental health are rooted in the algorithms more so than the hardware or even really the software, if it's the algorithm that can be separated from the software?
I think this is where we get into the sorts of questions that are really important, right? That, yeah, underlying a lot of social media apps, but you know, pretty much most of the apps that we use are things like recommender algorithms. And in theory, the idea there is that those things are there to make things more convenient for us, right? To make particular information or videos or whatever it is you're looking at easier to find based on what you're interested in and things like that, to serve content to you that might be of interest. And that's lovely. That's a really nice idea, right? But they do go wrong, and they go wrong really easily and really quickly because, A, even though they're very kind of complicated bits of code, theoretically speaking, philosophically speaking, they're still very simplistic and very kind of embryonic in a way. And B, if you look at the history of certain types of algorithms being developed, what algorithms do is if there is some sort of bias or some sort of problem in the system, they're really good at shining a light on that, right? So it's not that the algorithms themselves are the problem, but they maybe reflect problems with the way that they've been trained or for the reasons that they've been developed in the first place. So this is one of the big issues at the minute, is that algorithms can, for lack of a better term, I guess they can go haywire sometimes, in that they'll end up serving you content that, I know they're not sentient, but they think that you want to see, and it's very much not what you want to see. And I mentioned this a little bit in the book, but I've had personal experience of this in my life, you know, that 6-7 years ago, my wife got pregnant, and, you know, you start searching for stuff around babies, you know, you start buying cribs and researching nappies and things like that. And the algorithms learn that you are going to have a baby soon, or maybe you've had a baby, so you'll start getting more content that way. We had a miscarriage, and I very much did not want to see any of that content. But there's no way to train the algorithm quickly
It won't pick that up, will it?
It won't pick it up. And, you know, that can go on for months, right? And that's a really difficult situation to be in, because what happens then is, you know, you're maybe scrolling through Instagram or something like that, looking for funny videos. And then out of nowhere, there's an advert for something that really kind of pulls you out of that moment and really affects you. You know, and that's a fairly simplistic example, I guess, in a way. You know, you can see, and there are cases of this where much worse things have happened because of the sorts of content that's served. Now, where I think we may go wrong in some of these arguments sometimes is that what we immediately do there is reach out to, you know, regulation or outright bans as a way to solve this. And I don't necessarily think that that's the right, not the right solution, but the most effective solution. What we need to do is maybe take a little bit more of a long-term approach and think about how we can hold industry better to task to fix these things and place user well-being at the core of design. Because fundamentally what we're talking about here are technologies of convenience, technology of entertainment, things that are making, in theory, our lives easier and a bit more fun. And if that's truly the case, then they absolutely need to have our well-being at the core of their design.
Well, Pete, I think that when it comes to kids, my worry is a little different from that, though those are valid concerns. My worry is that the algorithms work, that they're just too effective, that they narrow and funnel. Do you think that children who are more impressionable, probably less able to understand what is happening to them in sort of a meta thinking sense, do you think that the algorithms may be particularly detrimental to children along the lines of those concerns?
My anecdotal feeling is yes, absolutely, that if you're not aware of how these things work, it's very easy to fall down rabbit holes. And especially if, you know, kids are not as well developed in terms of being able to self-regulate, things like that, that you can see that there's a perfect storm there. And I think that's what I'm saying about holding industry to task, that we need to have deeper conversations about how we fix that and how we individually might be better able to curate our algorithmic experience, I guess, for lack of a better term, so that we can help shape that so it's doing more for us in a healthy sense than an unhealthy sense. And that's particularly true for kids. So yeah, I think that is a very reasonable thing to say. I think part of this as well is, you know, if you think back to when you got your first smartphone, you might not be able to really remember it, and certainly might not be able to remember why you got it or what you did with it. I kind of remember, I was an early tech adopter, so I remember getting the first iPhone in 2007 and going, you know, this is great, this is awesome. Okay, what do I do with it? And what we've been doing since then is winging it, right? So we don't necessarily download an app for a specific purpose, particularly social media. And again, I'd put that question out there that, you know, I don't remember when or why I joined Twitter or Instagram, but I know I did join them. And you figure it out as you go along. And for some people, that works really well. For some people, it ends really badly. For some people, it's not a thing of interest at all, and they end up deleting it. What's happening now is the same process is happening with our kids, right? That they're getting access to this technology and they're winging it as well. And that's where we kind of open ourselves up to potential risk and harm, as well as, you know, benefits. There are benefits to these things as well. What we need to be doing instead is better curating that experience for them, to be providing better digital literacy training as well, so that before they get their first smartphone or whatever, they are trained in being able to handle it, being able to use it in a more directed and more intentional way.
So a second major thread in your book is on the evidence, particularly the evidence of screen time linked to mental health. Do you think the evidence shows that screens are bad for mental health?
So I think the absolute honest answer there is we don't know. I think that's, you know, if you look at the balance of evidence, we just don't have it in good enough quality yet. I am not convinced by arguments that take a very strong stance on this, that say that social media is the cause of mental illness. I certainly don't think that there's enough appropriate evidence to support that claim at the minute.
There are strong assertions, particularly in the U.S., that young girls' mental health has declined in ways that are coincidental with the rise of smartphones. So there's some evidence there, but the actual tight link, you're saying, is not as tightly supported as it's sometimes presented. Is that right?
you can draw very compelling graphs that show that they trace increases in mental health problems for a given definition of mental health problem over time. And you can draw a line down 2007 for when the iPhone came out, or 2010 and call it the smartphone era or the social media era. And it very clearly looks as though before that time, everything seemed to be okay. Everything was fairly level. And then after that time, things get worse. And it's a very compelling visual. And I think it's what drives a lot of people's worries about that. It's hard to explain away otherwise. I think the thing about this is that mental health, mental ill health, is extremely complicated. It's never the case that single factors explain what is a very complex aspect of human behavior and human well-being. It's very much likely that lots of things are interacting with each other. And part of that will be social media use. That will be in there. No, I don't think anybody's saying there's absolutely no effect there. I think that would be a silly thing to say. Where there are disagreements is in, you know, is this the single driving factor, or is this one part of an ecosystem of other factors that impacts mental health? And my feeling is that the best evidence that we've got at the minute suggests it's the latter of those, that there's not particularly strong convincing evidence that social media is the sole causal factor, but it is part of a wider story. And it's part of a wider story in quite a complex way, in that people, teens, can encounter bad stuff in their lives, bad things going on. And those bad things will be different things in different countries for different groups, but you know, they all have a similar sort of effect. And social media can interact with that to create a net impact on mental health. Which is the biggest factor, we don't really know yet. And I don't know if we'll ever know, because one of the things that I talk about in my book is that maybe thinking about it in terms of how do we pinpoint whether X is the factor on mental health or Y or whatever is maybe the wrong way of thinking about it. To my mind, the better way of thinking about this is, why is it the case that some people really struggle online and some teenagers really struggle online? Why is it the case that others who are seemingly in similar situations, they really thrive? How do we spot the differences almost between those different groups? How do we identify those ones who are almost at risk? Why are they at risk? What are the predisposing factors? And can we do anything about that? Can we build resiliency into the system for them?
Those are all clear thoughts, particularly when you're thinking about individuals, when you're thinking about your own kids and so forth and how they might interact with this. So full disclosure, I am not fully persuaded, but I find the evidence on phones pretty compelling from sort of an ecological situation. But your argument that, well, they're probably a contributing factor, but not the sole factor for what's been going on, has two things that I think are really interesting. And one is that if we overplay the importance of the screens and we miss the other major contributing factors, then we shoot ourselves in the foot trying to ameliorate this. Do you think that that's a very real problem?
It's one that I really worry about. So one thing that I've always said along is that, you know, there's a very vociferous debate going on about this at the minute. And I genuinely, honestly believe that everybody in that, academics on both sides of the debate, you know, no matter what your view of the evidence is, everybody wants to do the right thing. Everybody wants to help kids. You know, there are problems there. We need to figure out what they are and how we fix them. And where we differ is in the path to figuring out what's going on and in terms of the outcomes. So one of my worries around some of the discussions at the minute about banning social media or smartphones, and I say both because it's not clear whether it's one, the other, or both that we're talking about here, is that if that happens in isolation, if it's just a ban that we're talking about, it might look on day one after we've enacted that ban, it might look as though it's worked. Because, you know, things will change. But what about in 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 10 years' time? What sorts of effects do we see there? Because, you know, what we're talking about here is if that digital tech is not the sole cause, we run the risk of enacting something that we think is going to work, and then it's maybe completely distracted us from some of the other problems. They're actually bigger, and they're still bubbling along in the background. So you might get this unintentional backfire effect later down the line. And I should say that I'm not completely outright opposed to these ideas of I don't think bans may be the best way of talking about them, but like limitations in terms of age and things like that, as long as they come along with good, solid, evidence-based digital literacy programs for kids. Because if what we're saying is that we're going to ban social media, whatever you mean by social media, until the age of 16, say, and you do nothing until the age of 16 and then give a kid a phone and say, okay, you're 16 now, go for it. All you're doing is pushing the problems further down the line, and they'll still be winging it when they're 16, and they'll still, you know, potentially encounter problems and harm and still have those same difficulties. We've not fixed anything. We've just punted it down the field a little bit. There's that side of things. You know, we're just kind of pushing the problem, but we're also missing some of the real fundamental problems that do need fixing, that would have more of an impact.
If you think it was the social media or the phones that was as large a contributing factor to deteriorating mental health, let's just cabin it off for young people, do you think that we would have stronger evidence at this point? I mean, it's certainly being raised by some folks like, well, it's the phone, stupid, right? Like, there's no doubt about it. And if that were the case, would we have clearer evidence in the research? Or is it not necessarily the case that the sort of research evidence would be smoking gun quality?
I think the honest answer there is the latter of those, right? I think, you know, given the way that we go about researching these sorts of things and these very consistent cycles almost of public debates, public panics, reactive research to them, it takes a very long time to get to a point where you get good evidence that actually zeroes in on the thing that you're actually worried about and that you care about. So I think, you know, if it were absolutely the case that smartphones were the problem, I think we would see stronger effects in the literature. I think we'd have to, because they are so ubiquitous now, and you know, they are so global. They're really a core part of everybody's day-to-day lives. It feels like there should be a bigger effect there. But also,
of course, the ubiquity could also make it difficult to study, right? It could be that, well, we don't have a very good control group, so it's pretty hard to figure out because the uptake is rapid and pretty broad-based. And anyone who's not an adopter at this point is set apart because there's other things that make them non-adopters.
This is what makes the research so difficult, right? That, you know, you kind of hit the nail on the head there. And again, we've had these problems with all sorts of digital technology research in psychology for decades. It's the same sort of thing with video games, that, you know, it's very hard to do an experimental, tightly controlled lab-based study that has any bearing on reality, the reality of how people use these things. I mean, that's fundamentally one of the things that makes it hard. And you see people try to do this in the literature, and I really applaud people who try to do this, but also at the same time, you end up with a lot of not very good studies. A lot of studies that actually, when you take a step back and look at what it is that they're doing in terms of the methods, it just doesn't make sense. You know, I've seen studies of Instagram use where you present people with one image, a single image that looks like it's on Instagram, and you see these massive effects on how people report things like their body image and stuff like that. And at no point in papers like that do people go, well, hang on, if this was real, like if this finding was real, wow, the problem would be so huge, because this effect size is so huge for just looking at a single Instagram image. And at no point do we go, hang on, there's something that's not gone quite right here. Is this an experiment effect, a bias effect, something like that? It's clearly, you know, and this, again, generally is why it's difficult to do experimental studies on this sort of stuff, is because participants aren't stupid. They know what it is that you're looking for. It's really obvious. You know, I've done research on violent video games and the link to aggression. And the moment you get somebody into a lab and you give them a violent video game to play, they know what it is that the study's about. And what you then don't know is that the results that you get, is that because you've found an actual signal in reality, that, you know, that's what's actually going on? Or is it that your participants cottoned on to what's going on and they're giving you the answer that they think you want, that has no bearing on how they feel or what their perceptions are, but just they're trying to be a nice participant? Or is it the opposite? The video game studies, they're feeling really angry and annoyed, but they know that that's maybe what you think you'll find, so they'll pretend that they're not.
You like video games personally. I do too, actually. But there's a corollary here, right? That, I don't know, 15 years ago, there was not quite as big of a furor, but these regular kind of things that say, well, it's the violent video games. They're the reason that we're having socially deviant behavior by these young people who are playing them. I think that that has not aged very well. What do you think, briefly, are the connections between what we're seeing now? Do you think that this is a different... I mean, I think it's a different level of problem. I think it's different, but, you know, disabuse me if what we're actually seeing is the cell phones in the same sort of package for the video game fright of yesterday.
You definitely see the pattern there. It's really difficult, right? Because, you know, you have people coming every year claiming that, you know, the end of the world's going to happen. And that will always be wrong until... the last time in the world ends, right? So somebody will be right at some point. And that's an argument that's used in these sorts of debates. So when we talk about cycles of moral panics, and people are dismissive of people's worries, saying it's just another moral panic, you get people also saying, well, yeah, all those other ones were moral panics, but this is the one to worry about. And the honest answer there is that, you know, when you're in this cycle, it's almost impossible to say whether it's going to be a moral panic or not. What we do see is very kind of consistent, predictable cycles of how of the relationship between public debates and research. So what I mean by that is something happens, maybe a new technology explodes onto the scene, and people express worries about that. Then those worries become a little bit more extreme. Maybe politicians get involved in that and it becomes a national issue or a societally relevant issue. And then you get researchers coming in trying to figure out what's going on. And they scrabble around at the start and we sort of do very rushed research because we all feel we need to fix this now. We need to answer this question now. We need to do it straight away. So you rush in and you do some very quick, very relatively easy experiments. And usually to begin with, they're these sorts of questionnaire-based correlational experiments, which are always good as reasonable as a starting point. But the problem is that they seem to suggest something that confirms our fears, and then we get stuck in never really improving on that research base. We keep doing the same sorts of studies with slight tweaks here and there. And then what happens is over time you get enough studies published that all use these not great, but okay, but clear problems with them sorts of studies. But the sheer amount of studies that are out there is almost taken as evidence in and of itself that this thing exists, right? So I do work.
So lots of bad studies make the point that you can't make with a few airtight studies.
Yeah, and it's not even necessarily the case that they're bad studies, really. It's just that they're not measuring the things that you want to measure. So if I can give an example, I know it's a little bit off piece, but I do research on video games and how people spend money in them. And there's a certain way that people spend money in video games that people are worried about because it looks like gambling. It's a mechanism called a loot box. And it's basically you pay a bit of money, maybe like a dollar, open a box, and you get a random chance of getting either a really cool, really rare outfit or something, or a really common, really boring one. So it kind of looks like gambling, right?
It's a lottery, essentially.
Yeah, in a way, yeah. Now, the vast majority of academic research on that topic, basically what you do is you go away and you ask a bunch of people, how much money have you spent on loot boxes over the past month? And then you go, here's a measure of problem gambling. So can you fill this out? And you do a correlation between the two. And generally what you find in that literature is that there's a very consistent correlation. It's about a positive correlation of 0.2. So more money that people spend on loot boxes, the slightly higher their problem gambling scores. Whether that translates into harm or not, we're not sure. So from my own work, you don't see the same correlations with well-being and psychological distress. But a major problem in that research literature is you're not actually measuring how much people are spending on loot boxes right? What you're doing is you're asking them how much have they spent on it on the last in the last month, and therefore what you're actually getting is how much money do people think they've spent over the past month, and that is a very different thing. And we see a similar sort of issue in the screen time literature as well. There's lots of studies where you go, how much time have you spent on social media or screen time in the past week? And here's a measure of mental health. And there are some studies out there that have shown that when you ask people how much time they've spent on digital tech, and then you actually measure how much time, they don't correlate. Yeah, and that causes all sorts of problems for trying to understand what it is that we think we're measuring. But to go back to the point, it's this idea that you get all these studies that are not bad, but they're not measuring the things that we think that we're measuring, and we keep doing them. And then all of a sudden, we almost kid ourselves that we've got a solid evidence base for policy recommendations. And actually, the reality of the situation is maybe what's actually going on is we've only got one study that we've done 100 times, right, with slight different tweaks here and there, and it's not measuring the thing that we want to. So we're not any further along in understanding this thing.
All right, Pete, it's time for Grade It. Are you ready?
Go for it.
Esports.
I'm going to go B for that. So esports. So I've done some stuff on esports. I turned 40 last year, and I think I'm of that age now that when I see new things like that, I just don't understand them. So I tried to get into esports. It's just too fast and too furious for me. But at the same time, I know some amazing stories, particularly in the UK, where esports programs and tournaments have been introduced into schools, and you get kids coming along and saying, disabled kids in particular, maybe that come along and say, you know, I've not been able to take part in, for various reasons, in other sorts of physical team sports. This is the first time that I've been on the same like sort of level playing field with everybody, and I can be a really important part of this team, or I can manage the team, and it's given me that experience. And that's such a great thing. So, you know, I think there are issues around esports as well, particularly in terms of burnout and young burnout. But, I think it's the future, right?
Okay, so I'm going to give you a few very quickly.
Yeah.
Candy Crush.
F.
And why?
I just think it's a junk food game, really.
Fair enough. Tetris.
B, I think, yeah. I was Tetris one of the first games that I played on my Game Boy, and it was great, but very infuriating.
Open world games in general.
A, I love them. I think they're fantastic, and they're one of the best types of games that we can play because they give you agency. You can do whatever you want, and some of the most amazing experiences in games that I've had have been in open world games.
And just for those who don't know what an open world game is, briefly. What's an open world game?
So games where you've got essentially complete freedom to go and do whatever you want. So rather than, you know, you have to go from A to B to C in order to progress a game, you can choose whereabouts you go and how you tackle it.
Blue light. The health related questions. Oh, around blue light.
That's a tough one. I'm gonna go C because that's me sitting on the fence, because blue light definitely uncontroversially bad for sleep. Blue light from screens, I'm not convinced that it does anything in a meaningful way, but I'm sure there are lots of people that would disagree with me on that. But I think we worry about it at night more than we should do in terms of, you know, from our phones and stuff like that.
Teachers' understanding of neuroscience as it might relate to their teaching.
I'm going to go C again on that. I think it's generally not great. I've done some research on this in the past, actually, and it's a real problem. I think the thing about neuroscience is when you start talking about brains, people almost sometimes lose their critical thinking faculties and just assume that what you're saying is correct. And actually, you know, you can sell some really naff stuff to teachers under the guise of neuroscience when actually it doesn't do anything.
Online gambling.
I'm going to go F. I think the problem with online gambling is that there is sort of no restrictions, right? So no, you can do it whenever and wherever, and it's a lot harder to self-regulate those in those situations.
YouTube.
Ooh, I'm going to go D for YouTube. But that's probably a purely personal thing. I don't really use YouTube that much.
It's your grade. You can give it whatever grade you like.
I just don't have time to watch online videos. No, I've never found stuff that I've been... Do you know what? The only exception to that is during the pandemic or just afterwards, some guy set up a camera at Heathrow Airport and was like live commentating on planes coming into land, and it was weirdly one of the most joyous things that I've ever seen, and everybody was really getting into it in the comments.
That may have been the high point for YouTube. Last question: the quality of science reporting.
I'm gonna have to go E here, I think. I'm naively optimistic about science reporting, and I have a lot of friends who are, I consider, excellent science journalists and some of the best writers in the world, but in the broad strokes of things, I don't think we do a good job of accurately conveying science in the news.
All right, that's good. That's a wrap for Grade It. Pete, I want to do a little pushback on the evidence with some questions. There's this recent paper. I understand that it's a single paper, but I also want to understand how you deal with these papers as they come out. This one, I'm sure you're familiar with it, Sarah Abramson, Smartphone Bans, Student Outcomes and Mental Health. It's from Norway using administrative data. Here's part of the abstract. I show that banning smartphones in schools significantly decreases the healthcare take-up for psychological symptoms and diseases among girls. It affects bullying, GPA for girls, and their track in high schools. And it's more important for low socioeconomic kids. Hence, banning smartphones from schools could be a low-cost policy to improve student outcomes. Now, there's a lot of critiques about this paper that could be made. The effects are pretty big. Meanwhile, the actual diagnosis in this paper of mental illness didn't seem to track. So, a couple of questions here. Number one, this is a big study that scratches a lot of folks right where they itch. So they really like to promote it. I think it's a very interesting paper. But I want to ask first, what do you make of this, particularly with bans of cell phones in schools and what that might mean? But more importantly, what do you think the spillover effects are to this conversation about mental illness and phones?
It's a great question. That study is, so I've not done a deep dive into it. I literally just had an hour or so looking at it before we started talking today. And you're right. It's one of those things where in one sense, there's a very clear signal. Phones are bad. Here's evidence for it. If your prior is to be critical of this sort of stuff, there's a lot in there that you can be critical of as well. So it adds fuel to both fires. One of the interesting things for me from that study is I think a lot of people will just maybe read the top line stuff about the effects of a smartphone ban. And if I can ask you a question, what to you is a smartphone ban in a school?
Well, I think that generally speaking, it's when you get to school, it's in your locker or in your bag. You can't take it out or it gets taken away.
So I think that's what most people would consider, right? So they quantified the types of smartphone bans in this paper. And by far, the vast majority of schools that reported a smartphone ban, the ban was to put it on silent mode in lectures. So kids have still got the phones on them. They've just got them on silent, so they're not getting notifications when they're being taught. So what you realize quite quickly then is, well, what they've still got their phones on them, so they still potentially have access during breaks and stuff like that. So what is it that's having the effect here? And the other thing that sort of should probably mention two more things about that paper before I kind of go broadly. One is there was an effect on bullying, I think, in that paper. I've not double-checked this, but one of the things it seems is that the measure of bullying that they had was asking about bullying in schools. So one of the things that I worry about with, again, bans in the absence of anything else, is that what you're not doing is fixing problems around bullying. It's just you're pushing them outside of the school, i.e. they still might happen in the evenings and when kids are at home. And my worry there is what happens is it almost drives it underground and makes it even harder to see and to spot and to therefore do something about. The other thing that is sort of worth mentioning is that there's other research out there from Norway using pretty much the same data that suggests that smartphone bans don't have an effect and certainly don't have an impact on mental health and well-being. And again, I think this goes to the broader question you're asking there, is that this happens a lot in this literature. You'll find a paper will be released and it will have this big top line finding. You'll think, yeah, that's almost kind of like a definitive answer right here. Yeah. How do you explain away that, critics is usually a thing. And then you just start scratching under the surface and then you find this whole other literature that's comparable to that one paper that's got traction in the news that goes, well, hang on, we don't find the same sorts of effects, or we find different effects, and it becomes complicated very quickly. And I think that's one of the big problems that we have in reporting this and talking about this in the public debates, is that you're never going to answer this question with one study, right? We need convergent evidence from lots of different sources that hone in on this in the same sort of way. And we need a joined up thinking about this. What we don't see in the literature a lot, very rarely in the literature on smartphone, social media use and mental illness, is the best practice things that came out of the replication crisis in psychology. So it's very rarely the case that people, what we call, pre-register their study. And what I mean by that is that they say, this is the experiment, or this is the study that I'm going to do. This is the data that I'm going to collect. This is how I'm going to analyze it. And you say all of that and make it available before you do the study. You go away and do the study, and then you stick to what you said you were going to do. Yeah, and it's not a panacea for everything, but what it does is help you to keep more honest, I guess, in a way, in terms of how we do the analysis. Because there's so much flexibility and so much freedom in how we define things like smartphones, or even in this case, what a smartphone ban is, what mental illness is, there's very often a risk that we start messing around with the data, trying to find significant effects because they would confirm our beliefs, and, you know, falling foul of our own biases. So we have to be really careful about this sort of stuff. Take everything with a pinch of salt. Be critical of stuff that doesn't align with your worldview, but also be critical of stuff that does, because, you know, we want to get this right.
So I have been asked many times, you know, what do you think about smartphones and kids, and what do you think about these arguments? And I have a much less scientific answer for this. I usually tell folks, yes, it's bad for kids. Smartphones are bad for kids. And you know how I know that it is true? Because I know the smartphone is bad for me. I experience it. I make this intuitive case that I have very little doubt on that. I don't necessarily know that it's linked to mental health measures or cyberbullying or otherwise bullying. I just know that it's overwhelmingly not connected to the sort of behaviors that I want to do and the kinds of life that I want to live. Now, I also transmit this broadly. I think this holds for me, and I think it holds for, sort of across the population. What do you make of my intuitive case?
I think you're right. It goes back to what we were talking about earlier, that, you know, we feel as though we have these bad experiences, or the way that I would say is that we've developed bad habits with our phones because we never had digital literacy training or support networks to help us understand what smartphones are and what social media apps are before we got to them, because, you know, they've appeared as we've gone along with them. And you know, everybody has examples and stories about bad experiences that they've had on their phone, and they range from, you know, relatively banal, harmless but not great experiences to really seriously, really, really, you know, almost life-threatening in some cases, situations. So everybody has that sort of feeling. The key for me in terms of how we translate that into what our kids are doing, and, you know, when they get phones or whether they get phones and things like that, is I ideally want to make sure that they don't end up having the same experiences that we had, right? You know, we feel bad about those things because we didn't have the training, we didn't have the support network. So let's create training opportunities, let's develop support networks for our kids so that when they do get them, whenever they do get them, and they will get them because these things aren't going away, they are better equipped to deal with them.
Let me return to the school phone ban question. So I'm pretty much completely for banning phones in schools. What do you think of my prescription?
Sorry to be a really niche, nerdy comeback question, but do you mean phones or smartphones?
Smartphones, yes.
Smartphones. Okay, great. Yeah, okay. Yeah, so, yeah, I mean, people ask me this sometimes, expecting me to say, you know, I disagree with the ban, and, you know, my, you know, I've got a four-year-old daughter, and, you know, we have these conversations about when she's going to get one as well. And I don't think she needs a smartphone at school, not because they're addictive or that they're uniquely wholly bad for us, but just I don't see a need case there. What I want to be able to do, like I've said a few times today, is build some resilience, sort of like general life skills around resilience and being kind in her, and digital training, digital literacy, so she understands what these things are for and how and why we use them, and using them with intent. And my personal feeling with my kids is that, you know, they can have a phone at a certain age. I'm not sure what age yet, so that we can keep in touch, not so that I can track them, because I think that's a bit, that's a different conversation, but I think that's part of the problem here as well. But a smartphone, I don't see a need for a long time, really. And I think a lot of parents feel the same way. And there are these grassroots organizations in the UK that are really starting to drive this, right? It's parents getting together to say, we don't feel as though we've had good experiences with our phones. We don't want our kids to have the same. We don't see a need for them, certainly in kind of primary school, you know, school up until the age of 11, 12. We are all getting together to say that we're not going to give our kids those smartphones until that age. And I think that's,
It is something of a collective action problem, right? Because if your child is the one sticking out, the one Luddite child among the techno-advanced crowd, that's a very difficult problem to solve.
Yeah, and I think that's why it's so great to see these sorts of grassroots initiatives where parents are talking to each other and they feel comfortable about talking about this. I think very often when we talk about our own smartphone use as well, like there's almost like a guilt element or a shame element to that. And I think we need to move away from that and just accept that, you know, we never really properly learned how to use them, right? And we're just trying to figure them out and trying to do the best thing. And now what we're doing is trying to figure out what's best for our kids. You don't need top-down bans to do that. You can do it from the bottom up. And I think that's more effective, because what you end up doing then is changing social norms. That, you know, there are expectations around, we don't need our kids to have these. So it won't be the case that your kid is the one that's the old one out when everybody else has got a smartphone. It's the other way around. It's maybe one kid has a smartphone, but they don't feel singled out or embarrassed for having it, because maybe they've got good reasons for it. Maybe they've got, I don't know, maybe they've got diabetes and they've got a blood sugar tracker on their smartphone, and it's really important that they've got that. Everybody else has got flip phones so they can keep in touch with their parents and caregivers and friends and things like that. But, you know, we don't need access to, I say we don't need access to social media. And again, this goes back to, what do we mean by social media? Because when we talk, when we say that, we often default to, you know, WhatsApp, TikTok, Snap, Instagram, those sorts of things. But nobody's really defined what social media is, right? Social media is all sorts of other programs, Discord and things like that. But also, you know, you can look at things like Fortnite. Fortnite is essentially a glorified social media network for kids, because they go on there after school to play with their friends, their offline friends, their friends from school, and maintain and manage those connections. So I think we have to be very careful, if we're talking about outright bans, that we very precisely define what it is that we mean and we're worried about.
Pete, a few years ago, I was asking a psychologist about his fears for kids and phones, and he communicated it like this. He said, if you took ed psych in college in the 90s, you might have trained a rat to travel through a maze. Giving kids a smartphone, or adults for that matter, is like putting the child in the rat's place, but with a multi-billion-dollar research effort behind the maze that works on a system of rewards that just hopelessly outclasses the child or the adult. That's a pretty stark comparison. It suggests, wow, it's not a fair fight. So I hear many of the things you're saying about training and digital literacy, but two questions here. Is it a fair fight? And are some fights less fair than others? For instance, if you were to be suspicious of particular elements of what would fall under the umbrella of screen time, what would be your top two or three that you think are the most problematic?
That's a great question. It's really wide ranging as well. I think the rat analogy is a bit unfair in some ways, in that that only kind of holds true if you throw the kid into the maze without any prior training, right? Which is technically what you're doing with the rat, right? And I think, again, what I'm saying here is that we don't want to be doing that. We want to be equipping kids with the skills to be able to navigate these environments and be able to talk to somebody when they feel able to. I keep banging on about this, and that's not quite what you're asking here, but I think it's such an important aspect of this, that the thing that we want to really avoid is kids hiding their tech use. That the moment they start hiding it because they feel like they can't come to you as a parent or caregiver for support, that's when the real serious problems start happening. And we need to try and do better at that, I think, basically. That being said, I've not worked with industry at all, really. So it's hard to say, there's lots of like nefarious stuff going on the R&D side of things, because my honest answer is I don't know. We've had some insight into this because, the Facebook files that came out last year or the year before seemed to shed a little bit of light and maybe what's going on there. And I thought that was really interesting because everybody looked at that and went, this is evidence that they know that what they're doing is bad, right? And I looked at that, and a few of my colleagues looked at that as research scientists and was like, this shows to me that they don't know what they're doing. Like, this is not good research. This is not how you go about doing good research in this area. So it's either that, they don't know how to do this and they think they're doing a good job, or they don't care. I don't think either answer is a good one, really, but figuring out which one of those it is, I think, is really important in balancing that fight. I also don't necessarily think that we characterize all of our interactions with digital technology in that sort of combative way. Again, these are things that do amazing things for us, and we often forget in these conversations the level of convenience that digital technology has offered us, because it's just second nature to us now that these things are easier with our phones. So not everything is a fight. In terms of things that I worry about, I do worry about the industry ignoring a lot of this because they feel like they can ignore it because it's such high level and you've got lots of people talking at odds about how do we define social media and screen time and things like that, that they're just disengaged, right? And that's not great, because they need to be engaged and we need to be able to hold them to task. I think we've talked about algorithms already, but I think, there need to be better codes around how we design those and how we put well-being and social responsibility and just sheer like basic ethics at the heart of those. What else am I worried about? I'm worried about, I'm finding it hard to kind of say this in a sort of soundbitey sort of way, because the things that I worry about in terms of smartphones and digital tech are very sort of specific things. When you start to scratch away at the surface of these top level questions that we've argued that maybe the wrong way of thinking about this, you do start to see more targeted things to be very worried about. So things like online gaming spaces, where it's hard to keep track of what kids are doing in which areas, there can be breeding grounds for things like recruiting for terrorism and stuff like that. And that happens, right? And we need to address that. That needs to not be a part of those ecosystems. And people do talk about them. People are kind of worrying about those things and trying to tackle them. But it feels like, those are real, like, tangible problems that are happening that don't seem to get the same sort of airtime as these more wishy-washy arguments, I think. So it's stuff like that for me.
So, to take us out, this is moving pretty quickly, right? Tech doesn't slow down for people like you and me that say, well, we should slow it down here and there. Over the next several years, as we watch this, what would you suggest parents and educators focus their concerns about kids and tech use?
I know I've said it a million times to the point that people are probably bored of me saying it now, but I think the big thing that, if we did want government to come in and regulate things. For me, it would be creating national digital literacy programs. So we do train kids that they can spot things, they know how to spot things when they're not right and they've got people to talk to, but they're able to better navigate these environments so that they're promoting healthy tech behaviors and positive tech behaviors, and we're removing as best possible some of those more negative, unhealthy things. I think the problem that we've got, certainly for me from a research perspective, is that I very worry that the next new technology that comes along that we can't even imagine yet, that becomes what smartphones are now to us, we're going to go through the same cycle because we're not preparing for that as scientists, right? So what I would like to see happen over the next few years is parent groups having a bigger voice in research, teenagers having a bigger voice in research, and educators talking to researchers to figure out how do we get out of this cycle of getting the research wrong consistently and predictably, right? How do we create a framework for researching the effects of technology that is robust enough that when the next thing comes along that we don't know what that is yet, we can test it straight off the ground, right? We don't have to have these same sorts of conversations and scare each other. And I think that's the big thing for me, is that however we tackle these, however we navigate them over the next few years, we need to try and remove the really kind of visceral fear element from them and realize that we do have power. We do have the ability to change our own tech habits, our own tech use, change it in our families, in our school settings. We can do that. We do have that power. It's just figuring out what works best for us in our communities.
Thanks for listening to The Report Card with Nat Malkus. And special thanks to our guest, Pete Etchells. We'll include a link to Unlocked and to some of Pete's other work in the show notes. Also, thanks to our producer, Ellie Lucas, who makes this podcast possible. You can subscribe to The Report Card on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And while you're there, take a moment and leave us a review. It helps other people find the show. As always, send us your comments, questions, or topic suggestions to ed.podcast@aei.org. That's it for this episode. I'm Nat Malkus.